Welcome to the Business Trendsetter Podcast, where we talk about trends and how to grow your business. My name is Manny Turan.
And I'm Adam Hartung.
We are Spark Partners. Please join us at our website at sparkpartners.com to learn all about how to grow your business. Adam, a little birdie told me that there's some problems happening at Twitter, and it even goes above and beyond what's been happening recently with Elon Musk. So unless you've been in a cave for the past 2 months, you know, of course, that Elon made a big bid to purchase Twitter. And we talked about this at one of our podcasts about a month and change back. And so now, of course, Elon is pulling out of the deal, and it's starting to show lots of cracks. So I know we talked about it before, but I think it's relevant to discuss why and what is happening with Twitter.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that when Elon Musk said he was going to buy the company, the value jumped up dramatically. And the board of directors at first flinched and said, well, maybe we'll use a poison pill to try to keep Elon Musk from taking over. And then they did a 180 in about a week and said, oh, this is great. And Jack Dorsey, one of the founders and the sitting CEO of the company, said, I'd be thrilled to walk away from this company and let Elon Musk take over. And the board said, yeah, we want this deal to close. This is highly unusual. Most of the time, a company pushes off the suitor, says, wait, we got a company, we got a management team, we got a board of directors, we got a strategy, we got a plan. We don't need your help. You know, don't get in our way. For a company to say, oh, wow, great, you want to buy us. We're thrilled. The CEO wants to, you know, the former CEO, he'd been replaced a few months earlier by an internal guy. But everybody's like, we all want to quit. We want you to take over. It was kind of comical. You just don't see that happen. Now, you know, Musk has said, oh, you know what, I've decided I'm not going to buy the company. And you see Twitter hires, I believe the name's Wachtell Lipton, which is one of the very, very most expensive, highest-end securities litigation firms, to go after Musk and say, oh, no, you're going to buy this company. We're going to make you buy this company. Again, you just don't see people behave that way very often, they say, at least not a publicly traded company. And a big private company might say, oh, this was the cash-out deal. I was looking forward to selling so that I could, you know, my family could cash out and have a lot of money. But for a public company, it's just really, really unusual. And I think it's also unusual why Musk got all excited about doing this and now how he's talking about it. At first, he's like, oh, yes, we need free speech in the United States, and therefore I need to take over Twitter because I'll open up the platform and I'll put Trump back on the platform and revenues will skyrocket. And then within 3 weeks, you know, he's like, nah, never mind. I really don't think I want this company anymore. Yeah. And he goes hunting, you know, for an excuse to not buy the company. And what he comes up with is that it's dominated by bot traffic rather than being real people with real tweets. And that he doesn't think that the data he's getting from Twitter is accurate about how many bots there really are. But it's kind of like, you know, everybody said, oh, look, I want to stake my gold mine. I mean, you go into the assayer's office and say, I want to say that dirt over there, any gold is mine. Everybody gets all excited for it. And then it's kind of like, yeah, but you know what? Never mind. So I think all of that is highly fascinating. And so I think what we need to be doing is stepping back and saying, why is everybody so lukewarm? What makes this a situation where the board wants to sell the company? Now the guy who's going to buy it doesn't want to buy the company. Why would that happen? And, you know, I think I'm going to stick with the position I've had for a long time, which is that I don't think Twitter is relevant. And they lost relevance. I think they had relevance at one point, and they lost it. I remember very distinctly back about, you know, 15 years ago when Twitter was coming on the scene. And why would somebody join Twitter? And I was an early joiner of Twitter. And the thing was that with that platform, what happened, I could go on the platform and I say, look, what am I really interested in? I'm interested in innovation. I'm interested in business leadership. I'm interested in business strategy. I'd pick some categories like that, put my name with it. And then I would float that out there and I would say, you know, who else is interested in these topics? And it was kind of like, you know, just a bunch of birds trying to find their way into a flock or trying to form a
community
flock.
Community almost, right?
Yeah, a community of interest around these topics, and then we could share. Often we could share information. You know, like I'd say, oh, I just read an interesting article in the Financial Times, or I just read an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal, and I would you could share the link with people. So very short post with a very short link, you know. And the idea was we were sharing information as a community, and there was a lot of value to that. There really was. I quickly within just a matter of a few months, I had 10,000 connections on Twitter, 10,000 real connections, and that grew eventually to about 40,000. Then it was when I realized that a lot of those connections weren't real. They were fake connections, computer generated connections. And that made a mistake to join up with all these people, because I should have just let them be followers rather than actually get connected to them. And I had to go through and cull it down. And I think I culled it down to about 15,000, and I still have about 12,000 connections on Twitter. But that was the original value of the thing. But that's not why we see people on Twitter anymore. It's funny, I'm going to tell you, I looked up what's the value proposition of Twitter, okay? And let's see if I can get it here. Hang on one second again.
Yeah, what's remarkable while you look for that is if you look at the platforms as they are today and how fast they've been growing, the ones that are growing the fastest are heavily invested in video content, reels, very short form content, and I just don't see the relevancy from the user standpoint. I mean, my own children that are teenagers are not on Twitter. And if they're going to be the doctors, lawyers, and politicians of tomorrow, you know, they're not using these platforms, like for instance on Twitter, they're not using them at all. They're using, they're using Snapchat, using IG, and they're using TikTok.
So if you go back again to those early days of Twitter, media became an early follower of Twitter. And it was interesting. I got a lot of media reactions at the time in the first couple of years, because I was writing for Forbes and I had written the book, and I would go out and I would make some comments and link things up. And then reporters would contact me through Twitter and they'd say, yeah, we saw your tweet, we saw this or that, I'd like to get your input on some questions. So they were looking to see what was trendy. They were looking to see what was interesting, and they were looking to see who might have some thought leadership in these categories, right? So if you're a writer for the Chicago Tribune, you've been told to write something about, you know, a new company, Boeing moving its headquarters to Chicago, you could go to Twitter and look for who's talking about it, you know, and see what kind of leadership was out there, find somebody that perhaps you could discuss it with and get some good quotes. But that's changed dramatically now. Now the media watches it because they want to get quotes from celebrities that they can use, you know, say, oh, look what this politician said on Twitter. You know, they're now using the tweet as the quote rather than as a starting point to have an intellectual discussion.
So did you find the value proposition, by the way?
Yeah, I was going to give you 2 points on this. So one of them was a guy who went on Quora, where it's this open forum, and said, you know, what's the value proposition? And he comes back with, this is what people say, a real-time news source, a breadth of audience reach. That's it, just breadth of audience reach. These are not value propositions. You know, a real-time news source is a value delivery system. Breadth of audience, that's again a value delivery system. But I love this one. Fertile ground for trolls, bots, anons, and terrorists. That was pretty good. So then I went to Twitter itself, and I said, okay, what's your value proposition? And they say that it's an open service that's open to a diverse group of people. What does that mean? You know, what's the value? What service? What kind do you mean by an open service? Right. It says we serve the public conversation by having a global impact. We want to promote health, earn trust, unite profit and purpose, be fast, free, and fun. Again, none of that's a value proposition. It doesn't come out and say, look, you will meet up friends, create communities, be able to share information. It doesn't do that. And what's happened in 15 years is I think they really have lost their value proposition. And they've become this organization that's running this platform. And that's the platform, as I keep saying, platforms are just a value delivery system. It's how the platform Twitter created communities. You had value for the communities. Now what's happened is it's become this platform as a bullhorn or a megaphone for people that are famous, or celebrities. Here's an interesting statistic that I found.
Okay.
10% of Twitter users create 90% of all the tweets.
Wow.
There are 500 million tweets a day, but only 10% of the users create 90% of those tweets. And in fact, 25% of users account for 97% of all tweets. So what that's saying is that most of the people there aren't saying anything anymore. They're going there to just read what, you know, a politician, right. You know, most famous user, successful user in the political world of it was, of course, Donald Trump. And it's become that sort of, the value proposition is to be a bullhorn for celebrities. Since Trump was banned, the number one most popular person on Twitter is Barack Obama. Then number two is Justin Bieber. And number three is Kate Perry. So it's, again, I don't much want to go there to follow these people. I don't follow politicians on Twitter. I try to use it as a way to find people that I wouldn't otherwise talk to, right? I mean, I can go get information from Barack Obama if he wants to say something. If these celebrities want to make a statement, it'll end up in the press somewhere, right? I don't need to follow them on Twitter to know what they're trying to say. And in fact, I had a great experience about 7-8 years ago. One of the Kardashians was pregnant, and she went on with a tweet, and she said that she had woke up that morning and she felt really nauseous, and she had taken an over-the-counter product, and it had made her feel really a whole lot better. And my Mary Lou and I jumped on that in a hurry, and we contacted the manufacturer and said, "You're going to get sued if you don't get that tweet off that platform, because you've just made a claim. You've made a medical claim, right. You've paid Kardashian to make that claim. She could end up going to jail. She could end up getting sued. It could cost you millions of dollars." And it was, you know, this sort of very naive thought that people were having, saying, "Oh, if I want to promote a product, then I go get these celebrity people. I give them money, and they promote the product, and you know, I pay for some ads on Twitter." And it just reflected the fact that that's a value proposition that's not very powerful anymore, because if you want to be that, if you want to be this platform, then you need to talk about how many users you have. And I looked up those numbers.
What are those numbers?
The biggest platform is Facebook. It has 2.8 billion users. Okay.
Right.
And then after that, you get YouTube with 2.3 billion users. Then you have Instagram with 1.3 billion users. So, Twitter is between 0.3 and 0.4. So we're seeing one-seventh the size of Facebook. It's one-fourth the size of Instagram, right? Now, TikTok, interestingly, has 700 million users. So TikTok is now twice as big as, in fact, Twitter is.
Right. I'd be interested to see the growth rate of TikTok versus the decline of Twitter, right?
Yeah, it's much higher. Now, it's not the decline of Twitter, because I looked up, Twitter has been growing its number of users consistently. It's growing at more than 10% per year. They have some quarters that do even better than that. I looked to see if they were in a growth stall. Now, interestingly, they've not entered a growth stall, which, of course, two consecutive quarters of declining revenues. In fact, they've grown their every quarter, they've grown their revenues 10% or more. Most quarters, it's around 25% that they've grown their revenues. So I sit and say, okay, they're not in a growth stall, but the problem is they're small. They're small, and they don't have the relevance. So, because you can take LinkedIn, for example. LinkedIn is about the same size as Twitter. But LinkedIn is much more powerful. Why? Because we know why we go to LinkedIn. We post on LinkedIn for what I said earlier. It's a business community in a very real way. They're communities of interest. I belong to 61 groups on LinkedIn, and we share information about strategy, leadership, and innovation. And so those groups are powerful to me. Yeah. Also, I can make connections there if I want to
talk. Yeah, I use LinkedIn quite a bit. And this is actually a good segue, Adam, because I think that it's important for our listeners and our viewers to understand what you just said about growth stall, because I don't think that is a very common piece of information. And I know when I heard it for the first time, it was an eye-opening thing. And I think a lot of people that are in business today don't even know that is a possibility. They think that just flat or maybe slightly negative growth is survivable if it's, you know, if something comes up. So why don't you go down that rabbit hole and give us some thoughts about the idea of this growth stall.
Yeah, it was some of the original thought leadership that I developed going back 20 years ago. We tried to understand, could you identify companies that got into trouble and didn't get out of trouble? And what were those companies? What was the earmarks of them? And one of the things we learned was that if a company has two consecutive quarters of declining revenues, or you can do a year over year. So you say, well, my revenues are volatile. Apple's true. Twitter is true. The revenues quarter to quarter aren't always going up. They change based upon the quarters. Then you look at year over year. How did you do versus a year ago? And what we discovered was that if you have two consecutive quarters where your revenues are going down, you know, they're flat, they're going down, that's what we call a growth stall. And if you hit a growth stall, there's a 93% probability that you will not have a long-term recovery. 93%. Only 7% of companies that have a growth stall recover and get back on the growth path again. It varies from about 35% of companies are in so much trouble they don't survive 2 years. Another 20% of companies, they'll go into a longer term spin, you know, taking about 5 years to 7 years. And then there'll be another 40% of companies that will, they'll just go flat, they'll be up and down, but they'll never do anything great again. Think of Chevrolet. Yep. General Motors. General Motors is this flat company that just doesn't make any money. And it sticks around for a long time. It's not on any kind of a growth cycle. And so when we published that data in 2007, it got a lot of interest. But then people said, well, okay, that shouldn't matter if you hit a recession. Everybody's revenues go down. So now the data isn't any good because when you hit a recession. Well, we had the Great Recession of 2008, 9, and 10. And we've been able to back check the data. And in fact, it turns out that companies that hit a growth stall in the recession didn't survive. Companies that came out of the recession strong never hit the growth stall. They never had it. Same thing's been true in the pandemic. The companies that hit a growth stall during the pandemic struggled and a lot of them didn't make it. Companies that grew through the pandemic did well.
Let me make this point because I think this is super relevant. We talked about this about 3 weeks ago. About, you know, how to deal with the recession. And one of the things we said, and I'm going to repeat it again so that it ties everything together, is that if we're going into a recession in the next 9, 12, 18 months, whatever it might be, it behooves you right now to grow as much as possible. Create that path, that momentum, so that when you do hit that the recession, the economy does go into a recession, that you are actually, like we talked about, trending on the upward and not actually stalling out.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that the world may have a short period of time, like 2 quarters. The recession is 2 quarters of declining economic output. But what happens in a company is what indicates when you have these two bad quarters is that you've gotten out of step with something that's going on in the marketplace. So the world's continuing to move forward. It's going off and doing something new. And you'll do everything you can to try to shore up your business. You'll cut your costs. You'll lay people off. You'll cut bonuses. You'll reduce your spending on benefits and travel and things like that. You'll try to go out and fire your customers that you don't think are profitable enough customers. You'll say, hey, you don't do enough business with me to be profitable. I can't service your account. I'll cut off the bottom 10% of my customers. You know, so you start doing all these things to shore up your business. But all of those are trying to save your way to prosperity, and they never work. And so eventually what happens is you're now this small, you've got this business, and you're very tight, and you're very narrow, and you're very lean, but the world's going in a different way. And what the growth stall indicates is that the world's moved enough that you can no longer maintain. You've lost your sustainability. You're losing your relevance entirely. And so you see this happening with companies like Kodak, you know, big companies where they hit this growth stall and they're just not they're not able to make it over because the world's shifting. They're shifting to a different platform and you weren't there. You didn't take advantage of it. And that's why, you know, when we're working with companies, we tell them, look, you got to have a 10% per year revenue growth. And a lot of people think that's outrageous, but it's really not. If you think about it, economies generally grow at 3% per year. So you got to get 3% to grow, to stay even with the economy. Then inflation average runs about 3% per year. Now this year it's 8%. okay? Well, let's just go with the average of 3, okay? Now I got to have 6% revenue growth just to cover economic growth and to cover inflation. But the reality is you're using up your resources. People retire, they quit, they leave. You got to hire new people and train them up. Your equipment breaks down, and, you know, you got to replace it. Your property plant breaks down, you got to improve on that. You have to constantly invest in new product development. You have to buy new customer lists to get more customers in your business. You got to get salespeople to work harder and add new products in order to increase your sales per customer. All of that requires 4 more points because you've got to cover the costs of being, you know, a sustainable business, and that's 4 more points of revenue. So you have to have 10% per year revenue growth just to remain viable.
Yeah, now, to break even.
just to try to stay still, you've got to have 10% growth. And I can remember I was giving this talk back about 15 years ago, and I got in a loop where I was talking to some companies, and there was a lot of people that were insurance agents and insurance brokers at that time that were coming to my talks. And I was just looking at them and they were saying, well, you know, the world is changing and we're not able to do that. But my father started this insurance office and I'm going to keep it open. I'm going to keep it going. And what they were seeing was that people were buying their insurance online. Progressive and Geico were growing like crazy. And so what was happening was if you were a State Farm or Farmers Insurance Group agent or an Allstate agent, you were now getting pushed to become a financial broker, right? They were trying to get you to say, oh, just don't just buy insurance. Go to your customers and tell them that you'll sell them annuities or you'll sell them other financial instruments. And of course, these people were not financially trained. They were not sophisticated. They hadn't passed any tests to say they were a broker, right, a stockbroker or anything. And most of them didn't have the skills to do that. And most people didn't want their insurance agent telling them how to invest their money. They went somewhere that they could get more expert advice. And we saw those insurance agents just disappear. But that was a classic example of they wanted to believe that the business they were in was always going to be there because people would always need insurance. But the value delivery system was shifting, and as the value delivery system was shifting, they weren't capturing it, and they weren't finding something else they could do, and their revenues were stalled, and then they were gone, right? And they had to go off and get different jobs doing something else. So that's the base minimum. You got to get 10% per year. So that's why I always take a look and see, how's the company doing? Is Twitter getting at least 10% per year revenue growth? And the answer is yes. But I think the next thing you have to do is say, well, okay, what's your average basket size, okay? What's your revenue per user? And in going through that, I was pretty fascinated because things have changed very quickly in that metric as well. Today, the number one revenue per user is TikTok. And that surprised me because that's new. This is brand new information. This is 2021, you know, data. And they got to $47 of revenue per user. And that tells you that the media is seeing lots of users flock in. So they've gone, they're very fast user base growth, and at up to 700 million, like I said. And the advertisers are saying, I like this platform. It's short form. It's entertaining. People like this as an entertaining platform. I would say it's more competitive with YouTube than competitive with Twitter. It's a different goal. But it's growing, and it's growing really fast. Yeah. So they're getting lots of media revenue, $47. Now, the second is Facebook. Facebook has $31 of revenue per user. Now, the issue, though, is it's 2.8 billion users. So what you have is the Facebook platform is 4 times the size of TikTok. So obviously, it's much, much bigger company. And then Instagram is $5.25 across its 1.3 billion users. So you have Facebook with Meta with 2 companies that are in the top 8 at Facebook and Instagram. The third is LinkedIn. LinkedIn's $26 per user on its 300 million user base. And then YouTube is $8.50 on 2.3 billion users. So looking at the revenue per user, the Twitter number at nine puts it right dead in the middle of the pack. But Jack Dorsey has let that number decline. It was at 17 back whenever he retook the reins as the CEO. And it just shows to that inability to maintain the relevance. You know, as the platform has shifted, the advertisers don't quite know why they're there. And in fact, I thought this was fascinating. On January 8th of 21, Twitter banned Donald Trump from using the platform. The next week, the user base increased by 21%. So that tells you something about this platform as a megaphone, right? People are going there because they're voices they want to hear, and they're saying, "Am I getting the voice I want to hear?" Apparently, when the wrong voices are taking up a lot of the capacity on Twitter, people don't use it. So it's nice to say, "Well, if Twitter wants to be successful, I guess what it needs to do is go out and find popular people that can come on and generate lots and lots of tweets, so that those of us out there could listen to those and keep track of them." I guess it's kind of like those tabloids that are in the grocery stores.
The National Enquirer.
National Enquirer. It strikes me as they're sort of somewhat of a modern day National Enquirer, where somebody who's popular can go out and just start saying a lot of things on Twitter.
Speaking of that,
how relevant is it? Is the question I come back to. How much do we want it? How much do we need it? And what we've been seeing is not much, because it's just not growing.
It's not growing. And speaking of National Enquirer, there is a bit of a, I wouldn't go as deep as saying conspiracy conversation surrounding why Elon Musk would buy and then ultimately back out of the Twitter deal. But there has been some conversation that his 10-year Tesla options were about to expire and he had to sell them. And so being able to liquidate them and pull them out and all that was kind of a sneaky way to do that without affecting the Tesla stock. And so, he got $8.5 billion of stock that he sold. He paid $1 billion for the breakup fee, and he's spending some money on the litigation stuff. But I just wanted to throw that out there for your thoughts.
There could well be benefits to Elon Musk personally for the things that he's doing that dig in that I haven't even thought about, to be honest with you. And that could be an explanation for the actions that he took. But what he did do is he shined the light on Twitter. And you got to sit down and think now about what's the future of the company. By the way, 70% of all users on Twitter are male. I find that extraordinary. Just extraordinary. 70%. That tells you 30% are female, 70% are male. So that says a lot about the user base, right? I mean, you're not attracting women onto this platform, and there has to be a reason. There has to be a reason. Because like I said, Kardashian has been on here. Kate Perry right now is number 3 on the popularity. I think it gets back to the idea that, is this quality information? Am I getting anything out of this that's good for my life? And I think they've got a lot of males on here that are hunting around, perhaps, as that fella said on Quora, for bots, anons, and conspiracy theorists. I know that a lot of people that I talk to they don't look at Twitter at all anymore. People that used to use Twitter a long time ago don't go there at all. I hear people refer to it as a sewer of information. And it is troubling. I mean, it does indicate that it's out of step. It indicates Jack Dorsey didn't know what he was doing, and nobody's got a vision for how they would try to be able to create the communities. Facebook has created communities successfully. Instagram's creating communities successfully. LinkedIn is creating communities successfully. I'm not a big enough user of TikTok, but it's certainly bringing people in on the entertainment side. YouTube definitely brings people in to be entertained. You've got to have a value proposition, and I think somebody woke up and told Elon Musk that Twitter didn't have one and he didn't have one, saying that we're going to be more free speech, we'll let more people onto the platform. Heck, anybody can get onto the platform, and getting into never-ending arguments about whether what somebody is saying is good or bad. It's not just not beneficial. If people can go on there and say, I'm going to go be involved in a mass shooting, come watch me. Most people don't like that. Most people are going to say, I hear that a mass shooter posted up on Twitter what he was going to do and nobody stopped him. Well, why would I want to go to that platform?
The platform is archaic and it's not like, we've talked about, and it's going to be interesting what happens in the next, 6, 12, 18 months when the relevancy starts to degrade, and potentially maybe they will go into a growth stall, but we'll definitely be watching them and watching the conversation. I think mainly because it serves as a really good example of that very weak value proposition. Yeah. And this is one thing we talk a lot about, is the value delivery and the proposition, that there's a clear distinction between the two. And so I think this is fascinating, Adam.
Again, there was a point where Twitter and Facebook were two platforms that were moving forward. And what you see is Twitter really didn't develop its platform. It said, okay, this is my value delivery system. It's these short tweets, so many characters, find other people by yourself. You know, the whole platform really didn't change. Facebook, on the other hand, was constantly evolving its platform, constantly trying to improve to provide more value to the community. So, you know, connecting people according to their schools, but connecting them according to family, genealogy, geography, business interests, academia, all kinds of things that they found ways to connect people up. The story here is know your value proposition and keep making your value delivery system add more value all the time. If you do that by knowing your customer and staying true to the value proposition with an enhanced value delivery system, you become Facebook, which people may be mad at them now, but they've certainly beat the heck out of Twitter. Mm-hmm. And that's what we try to get people to understand when we work with them, is that you got to put the value proposition first. Why do people want to come see me, right? If you're an insurance agent, and they're coming to see you, then you better be offering some pretty good service, right? Or if you're just saying, well, here's the policy and here's the rate, they can get that online. They'll go to the lowest price, right? If you let the product become generic and that the state insurance agency makes everything pretty much the same, people know what they're buying, and you no longer have an advantage with the product, you better be smart about being able to say, hey, you know what? If you go online and buy that insurance, are you really covering your house? Because I've been to your house. It's a nice house. You've got an upgraded kitchen. You've got upgraded bathrooms. You go for that base policy and you have a fire. Hey, you're underinsured. Oh, really? Now I'm adding value.
Yeah, there's a value. And that goes the same for, you know, real estate and insurance and, you know, anything that is being replaced or usurped or, you know, the automation and the web presence is massive. Those are all areas where there's you got to really lean in on that value proposition.
And I want to leave this one with the notion that people that listen to this, they should call us up. If they don't have a clear handle on their value proposition, that's one of the things we can help them with really quickly. And we can do it very inexpensively. We can do these kinds of assessments of your current business and where help you discern, do you have a clear value proposition, just with some phone calls that is very affordable that can help get you back on the right track. Otherwise, if you're stuck just managing your value delivery system day after day and your gut's telling you, hey, I'm at risk and I'm not growing my revenues effectively, and this inflation is eating me from the inside out. I'm not growing my revenues, but I am growing my costs, and that is a time you should give us a call. We should be talking to you before you get to the growth stall, because if you hit that growth stall, it's tough. It's Blockbuster, you know, there's just an awful lot of examples of companies out there that just never
lots
made
of
it.
Example. Well, very well said, Adam. Thank you very much. Reach out to adam@sparkpartners.com or myself, manny@sparkpartners.com. MANNY. And remember to watch us on Futures TV and on Roku TV. Futures TV on Roku and on Apple TV. And we're excited for that partnership. And always welcome to reach out to us. With that, Adam, have a wonderful week, and we'll talk to you later.
Thank you, Manny.
Cheers.